The band of men struggled through the waist-deep water, soaked to the bone and freezing cold. Their chests heaved, sucking in great breaths of air, their nerves on fire with exhaustion, pain, and above all, fear. Arrows whizzed through the air and raised spouts as they struck the water, slicing through the stands of reeds choking the riverbank, slamming into tree trunks with a hefty thud. Every once in a while, an arrow struck home, and a howl of pain rose above the chorus of splashes and shouts. Two men on horseback pointed their drawn bronze swords to the far edge, encouraging their warriors onward. They could see the archers on the sloping bank above them, knocking and drawing and loosing their strings, filling the air with the promise of death. But if the band could struggle just a bit further, clamber up the bank and reach them, they might yet survive. Climbing up onto an island in the river, the edge of the water hidden by a stand of reeds, they thought they were safe. But the enemy was waiting for the war band on the dry ground, dozens of them, bristling with spears, axes, swords, and clubs. The two groups, hundreds of men in all, came together in a solid mass, dozens of individual collisions combining into a single sickening crunch. A bronze spearhead stabbed upward and took one of the horses in the chest. The swing of a sword cut so deeply into a man's stomach that it reached his spine. A flint arrowhead fired from above slammed into a man's shoulder, burying itself in the bone all the way to the shaft. A bronze arrow fired in the opposite direction punched into the top of a warrior's skull. A man raised his arm to ward off the blow of an axe. It snapped the bones of his wrist instead of his head. One warrior raised a wooden club as thick as a strong man's forearm and brought it down on a helpless man's head. Mud-caked warriors grappled and fell, sinking down into the churned-up mud, rolling and punching and biting and clawing and stabbing with their knives again and again and again. All of this happened simultaneously. One extended moment of frenzied violence that stained the mud and the slow-moving river red with the lifeblood of dozens of men. And then the moment passed. One side broke and ran for safety. A few made it, but more didn't. The arrows sought them out as well. These men also fell, splashing face first into the river, floating placidly downstream with shafts protruding from their backs. Hundreds of bodies choked the reed beds and banks, filled small pools of standing water with corpses, or had been dragged down to the riverbed by the weight of the things they carried. It was a cold day, and their last breaths steamed in the air. Soon, the water would freeze over. Ice would cover the bodies and lock them into place. There they would stay, hidden in the sediments of the Tollense River of northern Germany for more than 3,200 years. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Tides of History ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today. Hi, everybody. From Wondery, welcome to another episode of Tides of History. I'm Patrick Wyman. Thanks for joining me. One of the great attractions of archaeology is getting a glimpse, even for a moment, of the reality of past lives. At its most stunning, places like Pompeii or Akrotiri on the island of Santorini, which were buried in volcanic eruptions, we can even see a frozen moment in time. Plates of food, furniture, wall paintings, children's toys, and the bodies of those caught in a calamity. Exceptional circumstances of preservation give us insights into aspects of past people's lives in ways that are barely imaginable. There are few moments more dramatic than a battle, but actually locating and excavating a battlefield is frustratingly difficult. Even when we know the precise location where a battle took place, finding much in the way of evidence, weapons, armor, human remains, and mass graves, is a rare and precious occurrence. The largest and most devastating battles in the distant past are the equivalent of needles in a haystack. Nobody has ever really found anything of value from the Battle of Bosworth, the deciding battle of the Wars of the Roses in 1485, despite contemporary accounts of where the fighting took place and numerous modern attempts. The body of Richard III, who died in that battle, was only found after years of searching in a spot more than 10 miles, about 16 kilometers, away from the battlefield. That's not to say it's impossible. Archaeologists have found mass graves from other medieval battles, like Towton and Visby. They've discovered a collapsed tunnel from Dura Europos in the late Roman period. Decades of discussion and investigation found the probable location of the Battle of Teutoburg Forest, where three Roman legions were destroyed in Germania, and the location of the Battle of Chaeronea in 338 BC, when Philip II of Macedon crushed the last Greek opposition, has essentially been known since antiquity. But the farther back in time one goes, the harder it is to find anything. Cleanup work in the immediate aftermath of the conflict removes the items of greatest value and generally disposes of the bodies. Skeletons and artifacts degrade over the centuries. Repeated plowing of agricultural land turns up the topsoil and scatters the detritus of battle. Building work cuts through mass graves. The telltale signs of human conflict disappear, gone as if they never existed in the first place. With all of that in mind, imagine how stunning it is to find not just a battlefield, but one dating all the way back to the Bronze Age, more than 3,000 years ago. And not just to find a battlefield, but one with extraordinary conditions of preservation, such that we have hundreds of people's skeletal remains, a variety of artifacts and weapons, and a detailed view of the landscape in which the battle took place. The Tollense Valley of northeastern Germany has produced one of the most extraordinary archaeological sites ever found, a place where thousands of Bronze Age warriors met, fought, and died. Nobody had any clue of what lay beneath the surface of the ground in the Tollense Valley until extensive digs found the ancient carnage lying just out of sight. It's among the oldest battlefields ever discovered and excavated, and by far the largest of this extreme age. A decade of excavations and analysis has taught us much about what happened here, but we're still only scratching the surface for everything we can learn from this incredible place. It will take decades longer and the application of every scientific technique currently available, and those not yet invented, to fully understand what happened in this placid northern European valley more than three millennia in the past. For now, and perhaps forever, we're left with a series of enduring questions about this Bronze Age site. The society or societies from which the dead of Tollense came had no writing, and nobody would write anything in this part of the world for another 1,500 years. The winners and losers were all forgotten long before anyone set pen to parchment in northern Europe. No epic poem informs us about the identities of the combatants, a Trojan War-esque story that might give us some insight, however distant and muddled, into the events that took place there. As we try to understand, we're forced to rely entirely on the material record to answer our most compelling questions. What exactly happened there? What kind of evidence do we see collected along the banks of this slow-moving river? Who were the people involved in this battle and where did they come from? Why did they fight? And what light can these discoveries shed on the shadowy world of the late European Bronze Age? This is what we'll try to do today. Understand, to the best of our ability, a battle that left no trace other than what we've been able to pull out of the ground. Our answers must be speculative. Everything in this episode has to be prefaced with a might, or maybe, or perhaps. Occasionally, even a probably if we're feeling really cheeky, but uncertainty reigns. We can do our best to understand so long as we're aware of the limitations of our evidence and our interpretations. So let's start with the evidence. What is this site, or more precisely, collection of sites? What exactly have excavators found in the Tollense Valley? And what makes us think this was a battle at all? The Tollense Valley is a low-lying stretch of moorland located in what's now northern Germany. The Tollense River, which gives its name to the valley, is small and meandering. It winds back and forth along the marshy ground. People have been living near the Tollense since at least the Neolithic. The valley itself is unsuitable for agriculture because the land is so waterlogged, but the higher ground nearby is excellent for farming. Before the 1990s, river dredging projects and chance finds turned up the occasional human skull or bone. They dated from a variety of periods, all the way from the Neolithic to the Middle Ages. In 1996, however, an amateur archaeologist named Ronald Borgwart discovered something much more substantial. A fantastically preserved wooden club and human bones, apparently in their original position, along the western bank of the river. One of these bones, a humerus, the upper right arm, still had a flint arrowhead embedded in it. Based on the type of arrowhead, the bone and presumably the club dated to the late Neolithic or the Bronze Age. More bones cropped up, including a skull with a massive unhealed impression fracture. Most of the bones were human, belonging to at least a few different individuals, but others belonged to animals, namely horses. A few years later, Borgwart found another wooden club, also in position, with still more human remains. These were intriguing finds. They're actually unique in this part of the world in the case of the wooden clubs, and they merited greater investigation. An extensive research program began in 2007, and what it found was stunning. Human remains belonging to no fewer than 140 different people scattered along a stretch of the river at least 3 kilometers, about 2 miles long. A great many of those bones showed evidence for serious and likely fatal trauma at the time of death, what we call perimortem trauma. excavators also found dozens of artifacts, including 50 bronze arrowheads, jewelry, other weapons, and much more. Many of the sets of remains were concentrated in a few places. The most extensively excavated area, called Veltzen 20, has yielded dozens. Others were single finds discovered by chance. Underwater surveys in the river itself found still more human bones and artifacts. What's been discovered thus far is quite literally the tip of the iceberg. New remains were discovered in 2015, hundreds of meters north of what had been previously thought to be the edge of the battlefield. And only a few spots within that area have actually been fully explored. Unlike the scattered, occasional finds we see elsewhere in the river valley, practically everything excavated in these investigations dates to the same chronological horizon: the Late Bronze Age, with the most likely window falling between 1300 and 1250 BC. So, when we put all of this together, here's what we see. At least 100 sets of human remains dating to a tight time window, showing signs of extensive trauma associated with various types of weaponry. How should we interpret that evidence? There are a few possible explanations, and we should entertain all of them. One is that this was a massive cemetery, and that over the millennia, the action of the river broke up and displaced the graves. This is unlikely, though, since the dating of the remains clusters so tightly. Moreover, many of the remains were clearly unburied. They were simply left where they lay. Finally, practically all the remains belonged to relatively young adult men. That's hardly a representative sample of any larger population. The second and more likely possibility is that we're dealing with a large instance of human sacrifice, with hundreds of victims dispatched in a variety of fashions. This too seems unlikely, though. In other cases where extensive human sacrifices took place, the remains were concentrated in a particular place with some kind of ritual significance. The remains were deposited over a longer period of time, and any associated artifacts belonged to particular classes of items, again, with some kind of ritual significance. Moreover, the people who died at Tollense were killed in a variety of ways. The trauma points not to execution with a clustering of distinctive head injuries or slit throats, but to a much more varied and frenzied kind of violence. The most parsimonious explanation for the evidence, the one that best explains everything we see, is a single violent event, a battle. Sometime around 3,300 years ago, two or more large groups composed almost entirely of young men met along the banks of the Tollense River. They fought, and more, possibly many more, than 140 of them died. Some fell in the low-lying, marshy land around the river. Others died in the river itself or were thrown in after they were killed. Fresh sediments covered their remains, and many of them have been locked in place for that whole 3,300 years. Others have been moved around by the slow actions of the river or displaced by human activity, like dredging and peat cutting. Now, after more than three millennia, we can start to unlock the answers to who they were and how they died.
If you travel, you know how to pull off a perfect getaway. You know, after you enroll with your Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card, you get up to $10 back monthly on U.S. rideshare purchases with select providers, like a car to the airport. You know which remote retreats have the best herbal baths and where the Wi-Fi password is rarely used. Because you're the escape artist. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Purchases must be on card. Visit go.amex/you know.
Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
As we try to understand what happened in the Tollense Valley 3,300 years ago, we should start by getting a handle on the landscape as these Bronze Age people would have seen it. Today, the Tollense River is quite small and narrow, winding back and forth through a grassy landscape suitable for grazing and peat cutting. Decades of dredging have created a deeper river channel. In the Late Bronze Age, however, the river was much broader, slower, and wasn't as deep. The landscape in and around the river was marshy, full of stands of reeds interspersed with areas of open water and the occasional tree. The river changed course and flooded quite frequently, and at times, probably seasonally, the whole valley would have been essentially impassable. This was presumably why some group of people spent a considerable amount of time and effort to construct a gigantic causeway across the valley in the early Bronze Age, probably in the 19th century BC. This was an enormous construction of timber, stone, turf, and sand, stretching more than 100 meters, 330 feet, from one end to the next. Huge boulders with large timbers laid between them served to anchor one end, with sand and turf heaped up over the top to create an embankment 3 meters, 10 feet wide. Wooden posts, more than 300 of them, supported the causeway and the bridge portion over the river itself. Different construction methods were used at different points depending on the needs of that particular section, including wicker mats to hold the trackway in place where it met an eroding slope. It's a brilliant piece of Bronze Age engineering, a unique find in itself, even leaving aside the battlefield that surrounds it. And even though the radiocarbon dates for its construction go back to the 19th century BC, dates from other finds in and around the causeway suggest that it was in constant use and repair for centuries more, including the time of the battle. Basically, the causeway created a river crossing that people would have known and used for centuries, a persistent place in the landscape of this part of the world. The scholars who excavated and wrote about the causeway, led by Detlev Jansson, argued that it was probably the meeting point between the water route leading north to the Baltic and the land route that connected the estuary of the River Oder with the Mecklenburg Lake District. In the context of the Late Bronze Age, this would have been an essential spot on a significant trade and communication route between southern Scandinavia, the northern European plain, and central Europe further to the south. Amber, copper, tin, luxury items, weapons, and of course people would all have traversed the causeway, part of the fundamental but long-lost infrastructure that brought the Bronze Age world together. And if large-scale conflict were ever to break out in this region, this crossing over the Tollense River would have been a natural place for the opposing forces to meet. Archaeologists have recovered human remains from no fewer than 144 people who died in this battle, but there's good reason to believe that 144 dead is only a fraction of the total killed along the Tollense River. 77 individuals were found in a single tightly packed location called Veltsen 20. In total, the excavators estimate that they've uncovered less than 20% of the battlefield, perhaps as little as 3 to 4%, and a new round of excavation could easily discover more locations as densely filled with remains as Veltsen 20. Conservatively, 144 dead represents no more than half of the total casualties, and potentially much less, on the order of 20%. Those numbers are vague, but they serve as a baseline to estimate the total size of the forces involved in the clash near the bridge. Casualty rates for comparable battles suggest that somewhere between a quarter and half of the participants would have been counted among the dead. In total, then, we're talking about at least 1,000 and possibly as many as 2,000 fighters who took part in this Bronze Age clash. Whatever happened at the causeway across the Tollense River, it wasn't a minor skirmish. It really was a battle, and the forces arrayed on either side should properly be called armies, not raiding parties or even war bands. But if we accept that these were armies with hundreds or thousands of combatants, then that just raises a whole new round of questions. The Tollense Valley and its environs weren't particularly densely populated in the Late Bronze Age, so where did all of these fighters come from? At most, the immediate vicinity of the causeway and the river could account for one of the sides that participated in the battle, but certainly not both of them. At least some of the combatants must have arrived from some considerable distance away. But where? And assuming these were armies, which required logistical support and organization, who led them? Who gave them an objective that involved either traveling dozens of miles or fighting an encroaching force. More than anything else, it's the mere existence of this scale of fighting that makes the Tollense Valley battlefield such an earth-shattering find for our understanding of the Late Bronze Age. Armies of hundreds or even thousands of combatants implies it's the existence of leadership that could organize and direct significant forces, whether that leadership was charismatic and individual, hereditary and institutional, or some combination. that leadership must have spread over a significant geographic space to gather up such large numbers of fighters. We're talking about dozens of villages, fortified strong points, and lone farmsteads to produce enough young and middle-aged men who could participate in this kind of fighting. The overall population from which these armies were drawn must have consisted of many thousands of people scattered across large areas in a world that wasn't especially dense with habitation. What we're seeing in the Tolentse Valley are leaders with enough raw power and popular buy-in to put together large armies, at least one of which traveled a long way from home in pursuit of some kind of violent objective. That is genuine warfare carried out by high-level leaders holding sway over substantial polities. It's manifestly not the kind of low-level, if often endemic, violence that we've traditionally associated with what are sometimes called pre-state or tribal societies. Scholars of the European Bronze Age have spent decades arguing over the true nature and scale of violence in this period. Are all of the individual burials with weapons and hordes of bronze axes that we see in this period evidence of status displays by would-be elites, or are they a reflection of a war-torn world? Some have seen these things as signs of societies with interpersonal violence on an individual or small group level, endemic tribal conflict, while others have argued for something more substantial, true warfare. The Tolentse Valley battlefield firmly places the European Bronze Age in that more substantial category. We know that leaders assembled armies and took them to a crossing that must have been both strategically important and well-known. Hundreds of men died fighting over it. But outside the obvious but simplistic observation that some of the participants in the battle must have come from elsewhere, can we narrow down their place of origin more precisely? Where did they come from? A couple of different lines of evidence can help us answer this question. The first is the artifacts found in the ancient sediments of the battlefield in the same layers in which excavators found human remains. Arrowheads, spearheads, and the pins and fittings that hold clothing together can all be diagnostic. If we compare them to our existing knowledge of late Bronze Age artifacts, perhaps we can catch a glimpse of the geographic horizons of the people who died along the river. In fact, some of the artifacts do point toward a non-local origin. A specific type of bronze axe called a palstav, found in the river, is of a kind common to the south, in Bohemia, in what's today Czechia. Several types of dress pins found with the remains also point toward a southern origin. Many of the bronze arrowheads discovered in the find layer are socketed, something that's far more common to the south than in Mecklenburg and western Pomerania around the Tolentse. In general, the arrowheads are eclectic in their actual shape. This kind of typological variety is, once again, something archaeologists have seen in hordes of bronze arrowheads further to the south, in what are now Czechia, southern Germany, and Austria. If we were going by the artifacts alone, we would tentatively say that some of the participants in the battle came from or had connections to more southerly regions. We have another key tool at our disposal, though, one that should be able to give us more precise answers: stable isotope analysis. A 2017 paper led by the archaeologist T. Douglas Price used dozens of samples from the remains found in the Tolentse Valley to investigate the combatants, looking at strontium, oxygen, lead, and carbon. These isotopes give us insight into a number of different aspects of these individuals' lives, including their childhood diets and their geographic origins. The data is quite variable, but Price's team found that the samples from the Tolentse battlefield essentially break down into two groups, one local and one non-local, along with several distinctive outliers who don't fit into either category. The two groups had significantly different childhood diets, which is visible in the carbon isotope data, and lived in places where the underlying geology differed substantially, which left clear signals in the strontium isotope data. The locals had strontium isotope signatures that matched the region around the Tolentse Valley. The non-locals did not. The non-locals ate a diet heavy in millet, which wasn't consumed around the Tolentse Valley in the late Bronze Age, so far as we know. The locals seem more homogeneous with less variation in the strontium and carbon isotopes than the non-locals. The non-locals still clustered together, but probably came from a more dispersed area than the locals. Individually, each data point doesn't say much, but when everything is plotted together, the two groups show up pretty clearly. So when we put the artifacts and the isotopes together, we can see the outlines of the two different sides fighting this battle. On the one hand, we have people who lived in and around the Tolentse Valley and had presumably lived there all their lives. On the other, we have people who had traveled a significant distance to get there. The most likely places from which they came lie in a belt between Bavaria and southern Poland, somewhere in a rough rectangle defined by Munich, Vienna, Prague, and Krakow. That really was a pretty significant distance from the Tolnice Valley. The city of Brno in Czechia's old historical region of Moravia, which has the correct combination of strontium isotope values and artifacts from this late Bronze Age period, is about 350 miles from the battlefield. Now, we don't know for sure at this point, but the best explanation for what we see in the archaeological record involves a substantial armed force traveling hundreds of miles to fight an army of local people. Precisely why they came so far, who led them, and what they hoped to do are all less clear and perhaps ultimately unknowable. But we can get a better sense for what exactly happened when they arrived. The concentration and distribution of artifacts and remains tells us a story that will allow us to understand the course of events that led to so many young men dying in and around the waters of the Tolnice River. And that's what we'll explore next.
If you travel, you know when it comes to love.
See you soon.
Can't wait.
The sky is no limit. You know with your Delta Amex card, being oceans apart means meeting in Aruba. And booking a war travel with your card means saving 15% on Delta flights. You know kissing under the bridge of sighs guarantees eternal love. Because you're the long-distance lovebirds. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Take off 15 discount not applicable to partner operated flights or taxes and fees. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you know.
The archaeologists who have excavated and studied the material remains of the Tolnice Valley battlefield agree on a likely outline of events. We talked earlier about the late Bronze Age causeway that spanned the marsh and river in the bottom of the valley. An encroaching force of hundreds of men that included horses and probably baggage and non-combatants couldn't simply wade across wherever they pleased. The causeway and bridge were well known to locals and traders, and no matter how far away their origins, the invaders wouldn't have struggled to learn of its existence. The locals, by contrast, must have known that the outsiders would have to cross the river, and they would have to do so at the causeway. If they wanted to stop them, the causeway offered their best hope of doing so. Alternatively, the two sides may simply have blundered into one another at the crossing point, coming into contact accidentally. Whatever the case, it's essentially certain that the battle began at the causeway and then developed from there. One side, we don't know which one, attempted to cross and was met with resistance. The two sides exchanged volleys of arrows, and the battle's first casualties probably died on the spot. I say probably because no human bones have yet been recovered from the excavated sites at the causeway, but the signs of violent conflict are impossible to miss. Dredging sediments and investigation of the riverbed produced numerous finds, including that Polstav, the bronze Bohemian axe I mentioned earlier, along with a socketed bronze arrowhead, arm rings, and a local type of fibula, basically a brooch or clasp for clothing. Horse bones radiocarbon dated to this period were also found at the causeway. The meeting at the bridge produced a brief clash. Arrows flew through the air. Someone dropped his axe into the water. A horse probably died in the fighting. And it's a safe bet that some combatants died, but either their bodies were recovered after the battle, their remains were eventually swept away downstream, or the archaeologists simply didn't chance upon them during their excavations. After the initial clash at the causeway, the side trying to get over the river and marshland started to move north, downriver, probably looking for a ford or another bridge. Their opponents shadowed them as they searched for a viable place to get across the river. For the next kilometer north of the bridge, about 2,000 feet as the crow flies, human remains and artifacts were scattered along the riverbank. One test trench about halfway along that stretch, a site called Veltzen 32, turned up a variety of bones and artifacts buried deep under the surface. The people who died at this spot were probably trying to cross and were killed along the bank or in the river itself. Numerous arrowheads were found at Veltzen 32, suggesting that the would-be crossing was foiled by archers shooting down from relatively close range. The bodies of the dead fell there and stayed there, eventually decomposing and being covered by a thick layer of sediment. So they kept moving north, looking for another spot to cross. They tried again just a bit further downriver at a pair of sites called Vodarg 25 and Veltzen 12, facing each other on opposite banks. Even more arrowheads showed up at Vodarg 25, and it seems likely that both sides were shooting at each other as the running battle developed. A little bit north of Vodark 25 and Veldsen 12, the two facing sites on either side of the river, the two sides crash together in an intense melee. Veldsen 20, as this particular locale is known, was the scene of the heaviest fighting and densest concentration of remains that archaeologists have yet found on the battlefield. The footing here was better than the steep bank and shallow river of the previous sites. Veldsen 20 seems to have been a bit of higher ground, maybe an island, in the ancient river channel. It would have been a good place to try to force a crossing, and a good place to meet that attempt. The result was a full-blown slaughter at close quarters. At least 83 people were killed at Veldsen 20, along with no fewer than 4 horses, in a savage frenzy of hand-to-hand combat. Archers shot down at the combatants from an elevated position, spears stabbed and swords slashed, and when all else failed, the fighters fell back on last-ditch weapons like wooden clubs and even flint knives. Perhaps some of the defeated tried to flee and were shot in the back with arrows or were brought down from behind. In the end, the ground at Veldsen 20 was littered with more than 80 corpses compressed into a charnel house measuring just 12 square meters, about 130 square feet. These sites, the causeway, the riverbank, and the attempted crossing, seem to account for the vast bulk of the fighting. Spread out over a full kilometer, more than 3,000 feet of distance, the two sides stayed in contact, exchanged arrows, and fought face-to-face when they were close enough to do so. Further finds of skeletal remains 1.5 kilometers downriver to the north at another pair of sites about a mile beyond Veldsen 20 might be evidence of the victors killing stragglers who attempted to escape. The distribution of artifacts suggests that some of the bodies, especially those at Veldsen 20, were extensively looted after death. Maybe they fell on dry ground or in shallow water, maybe a pond, and so were accessible to the victors. Others were completely left alone, probably because they fell in deeper water and sank to the bottom. Some corpses were probably hidden in the stands of reeds choking the floor of the waterlogged valley. More than that is hard for us to say. If the two sides were on opposite banks of the river, why did they repeatedly try to cross in the face of determined resistance? Maybe they were hemmed in by a second force that made it impossible to get away. Maybe they were short of food. Maybe they actually were trying to get to grips with the opposing army to seek a decisive encounter and were determined to fight a significant battle. We can't even say for sure who won the battle, though obviously both sides suffered casualties in the fighting based on the local versus non-local groupings and the isotopic data taken from the human remains. None of the bodies recovered thus far seem to have been deliberately buried. Maybe there's a cemetery or the remains of a massive funeral pyre still waiting to be discovered, or maybe nobody made the effort at all. Over time, the bodies decomposed. The river continued its relentless action, flowing through the valley and depositing sediments. Some bodies, like the relatively intact remains found at Veldsen 20, were covered relatively quickly. Others, however, were subject to continuous pressure from the river. The larger bones, like those of the skull, arms, legs, and ribs, often remained where they had fallen. But smaller bones, like those of the feet and hands, were carried away by the rushing water. Decades of dredging the river, digging up the riverbed and depositing the soil on land, has left individual, disarticulated bones scattered across the floor of the valley. Some have been washed away forever, never to be found, while others have decomposed into nothing. But there are almost certainly still significant quantities of remains waiting to be discovered. Some close to the surface, as at Veldsen 20, others buried deep under millennia of sediment like the old riverbank at Veldsen 32. We're barely scratching the surface of what we can know about this ancient battlefield. But what about the people themselves? What can we say about them as people, about their experiences before and during this battle? Can we tell a story about them? I think we can. We can't do so as individuals. We simply don't have collated sets of different kinds of data about an individual set of remains that includes physical descriptions of the bones, isotopes, DNA, and artifacts. All of that, and preferably more, would be necessary for us to tell a complete, real late Bronze Age person's life story. But we do have scattered bits of data, enough that we can say some things about these warriors as a whole in an impressionistic way that gives us some insights into who they were as people and what they went through. In the time we have left today, let's try to do that. When we look at the sample of remains recovered from the battlefield, one thing immediately jumps out. Practically all of them belong to young men between the ages of 16 and 40. One or two might belong to older children just below that age threshold, and in a couple of cases, the bones are ambiguous enough that they could belong to women. It's obvious, however, that we're dealing with armies composed almost entirely of prime-aged men. Their bones show that they were extremely active, with strong muscle attachments and some preference for right-handed activity. But who were they? Amateurs experiencing their first taste of fighting, or experienced warriors? The researchers who have examined the entire corpus of skeletal material, led by Gundula Lidke, argue strongly that these armies included, or were made up largely, of people who had faced combat before. The sample of remains contains copious evidence for healed injuries. 40 of the 144 currently known individuals show healed trauma. And remember, that's only the healed injuries that left a trace in the bones that we have. We don't have anywhere close to all the bones. That doesn't include soft tissue injuries. Many of these healed injuries, like fractured ribs and collarbones, could have come from a variety of causes, but a substantial proportion of those healed injuries were the unequivocal result of violence. The sample includes numerous healed impression fractures on skulls, lesions left by arrows and spearheads, and perifractures, when a person suffers a break of the forearm in an attempt to ward off a blow. Now, it's possible that violence was so endemic in Bronze Age society that lots of people got stabbed or clubbed from time to time. But no other skeletal sample from this period shows the extent of healed trauma, or such concentrated evidence of past violence that the Tolensa remains display. Some significant portion of the dead were either full-time professional warriors, or at the very least part-time but experienced fighters. The range of weaponry found at the site supports this conclusion. Only one sword has been found, a fragment, actually, but the distribution of cutting injuries suggests that they were more widely used. Wielding a sword effectively is a skill that takes significant time to master. The same goes for bronze spears, which left numerous stabbing lesions on bones. An amateur can use a spear, but experts use them much more effectively. Bows and arrows played a significant role in the fighting. Dozens of bronze and stone arrowheads have been found scattered around the valley, and no fewer than 18 of the dead from Veldsen 20 alone have traumatic injuries from arrows. Archery is a demanding skill to learn. It's not something one picks up in an afternoon. That's less true of wooden clubs, but the clubs found at the site weren't simple sticks that somebody had picked up off the ground. They were specialized, well-shaped weapons. One of them looks like a baseball bat, another like a croquet mallet or a maul. The upshot of the healed trauma and weaponry used in the battle is that Bronze Age Europe produced large bodies of men who knew how to fight, did so regularly, and benefited socially from their violent activities. Archaeologists have long pointed to the prevalence of weapons in burials, especially high-status burials, from this period. Now, it's clear that the weapons weren't for show and they weren't status displays. They were part of the fabric of a specialized portion of society's way of life. The presence of horses, fine gold jewelry, and various types of weaponry tells us that there was an internal hierarchy within each army and differentiated roles. That's what we would expect in a hierarchical society with professional or experienced amateur warriors. When they approached the causeway across the Tolensa Valley, both sides knew what they were doing. Some had been born and raised nearby, but had nevertheless put in the time and work to become skilled fighters. Others had come from far away, probably far to the south, drawn north by some force we can never really know. If their prior lives and the paths that led them down to the marshy edges of the Tolensa River are shadowy, their ends are crystal clear. The patterns of perimortem trauma, meaning the injuries sustained at the time of death, tell a horrifying story. One man, a non-local around 40 years old, was shot with at least 3 and probably 4 flint arrows. Once in the left shoulder blade, once in the upper right arm, once in the right shin, and possibly once in the right hand or wrist. He was hardly the only one. At least 19 different arrow injuries have been documented in the massive bodies at Veldsen 20 alone, half to the front and half to the back. One man was shot through the skull with a bronze arrow that penetrated into his brain. Another died with a flint arrowhead lodged deeply in his upper arm. Cut and stab wounds, desperation injuries incurred in the attempt to ward off lethal blows marked the forearms of multiple men. Dozens of stab wounds from swords, spears, and knives show up across the bones of the ribcage and spine. 4 men in the grave at Veldsen 20 had their heads bashed in, presumably with clubs. One combatant was stabbed so forcefully in the leg with a bronze spear that his femur snapped in half, producing the kind of injury normally seen today in a motorcycle accident. We can imagine the final melee at Veldsen 20. Arrows whizzing through the air, fired down toward the river from the higher ground on the bank. Horses whinnying and neighing in terror. boots splashing in shallow water, feet sticking in the churned up mud, desperately trying to find a stable spot from which to stab with a bronze spear or swing a sword. Frenzied swings with clubs and axes, the dull thud of dense wood and bronze striking flesh, and, rising above it all, the yells of fear and triumph and pain, boys who hadn't yet reached manhood fighting and dying in their first battle alongside fathers, friends, and enemies. Their bodies would remain more or less where they fell, disturbed only by the looters carrying away valuable swords, spears, jewelry, and anything else worth taking immediately after the fighting was over. Did anyone remember the dead? Perhaps the survivors raised a horn of mead or beer in their memory and celebrated their glorious deeds, or composed epic poems about their bravery that were handed down through the generations afterwards. Or perhaps they didn't. Maybe the survivors carried their wounds, both physical and mental, for the rest of their lives, and preferred to forget the savagery that took place along the Tolensa River that day. Whether it took a year or a millennium, the dead of Tolensa were eventually forgotten, the occasional bone protruding from the riverbank the only reminder that they had ever lived at all. It's taken decades of archaeology to recover even the barest details of their existence. Far too often, young men across history have been told that acts of violence will make them immortal. They might die, but they will leave their mark in history and legend, shaping the world after them with their deeds. The dead of Tolensa demonstrate, once for all, that's not the case. For every Achilles or Horatius at the bridge whose reputation lives forever, there are thousands of forgotten corpses at places like Tolensa, whose lives ended not in glory or everlasting memory, but in blood, terror, and pain. Next time on Tides of History, we'll finally be at the end of our prehistory season. We'll finish with a retrospective, a look back at everything we've covered over the past 2 years, and some new discoveries that have cropped up in the interim. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Tides of History ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey. I've also written a book called The Verge: Reformation, Renaissance, and 40 Years That Shook the World. It's available now on hard copy, paperback, ebook, or audiobook that I read, of course, from your distributor of choice. There's a link in this episode description that will take you there. Tides of History is written and narrated by me, Patrick Wyman, sound designed by Derek Behrens for Airship, audio editing by Molly Bach for Airship. The sound engineer is Sergio Enriquez. Tides of History is produced by Morgan Jaffe. From Wondery, the executive producers are Jenny Lower-Beckman and Marshall Louie. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, from Wondery, this has been Tides of History.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.